Hey gang, this episode is brought to you by Means TV, the world's first anti-capitalist streaming service. Stick around after the episode to learn a bit more about Means and to snag a nice little discount as a thank you for supporting my channel. Earlier this year, about 50,000 dock workers went on strike for the first time in almost 50 years.
Dock workers are on strike.
Tens of thousands of workers.
They're striking over pay and concerns about automation.
This is going down in history, what we're doing here.
For 3 days, workers on the East Coast shut down 36 ports going all the way from Boston to Houston, blocking about half of the U.S.'s imports and two-thirds of the U.S.'s exports via container. At around $5 billion a day, this was one of the most costly strikes for shipping companies ever. As you might have heard, these dock workers were striking for very reasonable things. Things like higher wages and protection from automation now that their current contract has expired. It's not yet clear exactly what their new contract will look like, but thanks to the three-day strike, they've got a tentative deal for a massive 60% raise over the next 6 years. The automation issue isn't resolved yet, but soon, the highest paid dock worker will be making about $63 an hour. And this is pretty amazing. In a world of mass layoffs and wages getting eaten away by inflation, workers just got a huge result in just 3 days. Because while workers' wages were slowly stagnating and the threat of automation kept increasing, the shipping industry made $400 billion in profit in just the last 3 years. For reference, that's more than they had made in total since 1957. Keep that in mind, by the way, if you ever see a Wall Street Journal op-ed trying to paint these workers as greedy for wanting to be paid fairly or fear-mongering about the inflation that these sorts of strikes could cause. There would be no inflation if companies didn't raise their prices, and they clearly have the profit margins there to not do that. But anyway, in this video, I want to take a step back from this specific case and get a little bit more general. We need to talk about how exactly unions are able to do amazing things like this, how they resist capitalist greed, and how that benefits all of us. We're all familiar with bosses refusing to listen to our complaints and throwing pizza parties instead of, you know, paying us better. So rather than fall into the depressing idea that a cold slice is all there is, I want to go over what makes unions such a powerful asset, prepare you for some of the things that employers have tried to do to hijack their potential, and at the end, I want to give you some concrete steps if you'd like to unionize your workplace. Here's the timestamp if you want to skip right to that, by the way. Because although support for unions is at an all-time high, unionization rates are actually still going down. And if your first reaction after hearing about the dock workers' victory is irritation or bitterness that you don't make as much, stick around, because union membership could be the solution. On average, union membership means an extra $1.3 million for you by the time you retire. That's a lot. And that's not the only thing. Higher wages, better benefits, increased job safety. Most people know unions are good, but what makes a strong union isn't always as obvious. Historically, some of the strongest unions have been at strategic choke points in the economy, like coal mining, rail, and shipping. It's in these industries, around the 1880s and 90s, that workers discovered the power of sabotage. The ability to use relatively small disruptions in the production process that could yield massive effects and hit capitalists where it hurts most, their wallets. Here's how a very coy leader of the French Railwaymen's Union put it in 1895. With 2 pennies worth of a certain substance used in the right way, we can make a locomotive unable to work. A single operator at the right place at the right time could throw off an entire schedule, and therefore a group of organized workers could threaten to completely grind entire economic sectors to a halt. And with strikes and sabotage starting so far up the production chain, other unionized industries could take note and join further down the line, turning a single act of industrial sabotage into a society-wide general strike. Obviously, here at Second Thought, we wouldn't condone any such action. But the strike isn't the only tool workers have. Often, just slowing down is enough to get the boss to agree to workers' demands. In 1899, for example, dock workers went on strike in Glasgow after their employers refused to give them a 10% raise. To break the strike, agricultural workers were brought in until the longshoremen were forced back to the docks. Now, these agricultural workers were, of course, not as good at the job as the trained professionals they replaced. But since the capitalists had said they were just as happy with the quality of their work, the dock workers agreed to come back and work just as clumsily and slowly as those that had replaced them. Like today, it only took 3 days of this for dock workers to get their 10% pay bump. Similarly, where strikes or unions were made illegal, workers found alternate ways to protest. In France, for example, a strike ban under rail nationalization was met by railroad workers with a simple commitment to follow the exact wording of the safety regulations. The rule said that engineers needed to ensure the safety of every bridge a train would cross, and get a confirmation from another member of the crew if they weren't sure. So, until their demands were met, that's exactly what they did. Engineers audited every single bridge a train would cross, causing massive delays and forcing the hand of the state to listen. Gotta love the French. That's pretty good. These sorts of acts are exactly the kind of things that happened for decades between the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century. Workers found little tricks, lost crucial pieces of equipment, magically all fell sick on the same day, or simply refused to collect payments from customers to temporarily slow down their boss's revenue into submission. These are strategies available to most, if not all, workers, and the historical record has proven that they are some of the most effective ways to get things to change. Because it's thanks to these actions that bits of real democracy took shape in Western countries. We often hear that democracy is the product of great ideas, but the reality is that this leverage that workers had over the entire economy, their ability to turn off the tap for things like energy and imports, was really what made democracy available to more than just the rich and powerful. For the simple reason that strikes prevent capitalists from just doing whatever they want. When workers strike, it hurts capitalist profits, yes, but more than the strike itself, it's the threat of the strike that keeps bosses from firing workers and cutting wages. And in these early years of labor action, workers used their leverage to demand a place in society that the existing political system refused to give them. Government was limited to the owners of property, capitalist men who owned land, but often also literally owned women, servants, and slaves. If it hasn't always been an explicit requirement, government has always been the domain of the rich and powerful in practice. And when these institutions thought there was no problem with their rich and powerful buddies putting children to work, forcing labor to come in 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, workers then had to develop a way to fight back, to gain collective rights and improve life for all of us, to find a way to exercise power in a system that was designed to exclude them. Now, capitalists came up with dozens of ways to fight this. The welfare state as we know it, for example, only exists as a compromise the state and capitalists made with labor so they could have a paternalistic control over the common good. They didn't like the majority of society being able to impose their outrageous demands of a comfortable life for all. Better to concede on some demands than to give up the power to set the rules. This is the same strategy that's behind what are called company, or sometimes yellow unions. These were especially popular in the early 20th century. The point is to have an in-house union, essentially controlled by the boss, that can filter the demands of workers and get them to a compromise without there ever being a real risk of a profit-interrupting strike. This obviously makes unions a lot weaker, a lot less threatening, and therefore a lot more popular among capitalists. And the reason they exist is because, just before they started popping up everywhere, the conventional method capitalists had used to silence workers' demands was literally killing them. The Rockefellers, for example, famously set the National Guard on Colorado coal miners trying to unionize in 1913. And the bloodbath was so insane, the number of casualties so high, that the resulting nationwide political crisis actually threatened the Rockefellers' ownership of the mines. Workers, organized and stigmatized by capital, were too much of a threat not to be pacified somehow. Now, since 1935, these kinds of unions have been outlawed. But if they're illegal, that doesn't mean they can't still exist in practice. Plenty of unions can easily fall victim to the intimidation tactics capitalists use to force workers to compromise and protect company profits over their own demands. So, this next section of the video is hopefully going to clear up how you might want to set up a union where you work, and how to make sure it doesn't become completely neutered by your boss. So if your job isn't unionized already, what does it take to make that happen? The first step is talking to some of your coworkers one-on-one. The goal here is to figure out who might be interested in joining a union, who's maybe going to need a little more time or convincing, and who's probably not going to be up for it. The website Unions for All that I've linked in the description has some example questions you can start with to get a sense of what people think. These are phrased a little awkwardly, so don't feel like you have to stick to them as written. The point is just to suss out if people are generally happy with things like shifts, paychecks, leadership, and so on. The point is not to sell them on joining a union, it's just to hear what things they're upset about that either you have in common or you haven't thought of yet. A good recommendation here is to keep a private list of this sort of stuff that you're sure won't get to your boss. That's very important. Writing down how different people feel and what they want to see changed is not only going to make the possibility of a union more tangible and appealing for more people, it's going to help you actually identify your demands down the line. But again, your boss cannot see this. Now, once you've got this information, you'll probably see that there are a couple grievances that keep popping up. These are going to become the rallying call that'll get people on your side and focus your union's energy on one or two productive and winnable goals. At this stage, better just to narrow your scope and gain momentum than try to address every single little thing. It's also probably around this stage that you'll want to reach out to an organization like the IWW or the AFL-CIO. These are organizations that coordinate between thousands of unionized workers and existing unions, and can give you concrete next steps to take the grassroots support you're starting to build and make it into an official union with real collective bargaining power. If you work for a bigger company, odds are that there are already people organizing in some other department, location, or just generally in your industry. For example, auto workers and academic workers have the UAW. Public school teachers have the NEA and the AFT. Amazon workers have the ALU. Starbucks workers have the SBWU. Writers have the Guild. You get the idea. No matter what your job is, odds are someone else doing something similar has figured out how to unionize. Reaching out to one of these bigger organizations usually just takes filling out a quick form, and then they'll get you in touch with a representative who has actual experience organizing a union safely. There are legal protections in place to make sure that you can organize your workplace, and having someone who can help you go through the process correctly and with strategies that have worked before can save you a lot of stress. You don't have to know everything to get started. Bosses are well known for breaking the law to prevent or dissolve a union, and having that institutional support from union organizers can make sure that every little bit of shady shit gets written down and that you know your rights. At this point, once you've gotten some help, the next step will probably be collecting signatures from your coworkers to get managers to recognize your union. This can go smoothly, and your boss agrees to your demand to form a union, or you can face some resistance. If your boss does not recognize your union and you have a majority of your coworkers ready to vote yes on unionizing, you'll be able to file a petition with the NLRB to formally organize a union without needing your boss's approval. To do this, you'll need at least 30% of your coworkers to agree to file and 50% of your coworkers to vote yes on forming a union the day of the actual election. This time between the petition and the election is when your managers will be the most insufferable. They'll lie, intimidate, threaten, or otherwise discourage you and your coworkers from unionizing. They might threaten to fire you for unionizing. They might hit you with mandatory meetings with consultants or managers trying to convince you that a union will actually make your life worse, that the dues will be too high, and that you'll lose freedom somehow. They'll lie and tell you they'd be happy to negotiate so long as there isn't a union rep in the room. Don't fall for it. Remember, if they thought they could, they'd happily work you to death for a quick buck. A lot of these strategies are illegal, and having a union and a union federation to back you up and protect you will get you the things you deserve. The benefits of a union always outweigh the costs. Always. For example, dues rarely go over 2% of your paycheck, but the average union worker makes nearly 20% more than the average non-union worker. They will try everything, even the illegal threats and firing, because they know deep down that unionization comes with tremendous power. Power to act in the best interest of the majority of people and not blindly follow the dictates of profit. Just earlier this year, for example, we've seen amazing feats of solidarity come from unions all over the world. In Greece, dozens of unionized dock workers were able to stop a shipment of ammunition intended for the Israeli genocide of Palestinians in Gaza. When war profiteers would happily continue to send hundreds of thousands more people to their deaths, the people all along the supply chain who would actually have to carry that out can put a stop to it. Without workers, those weapons don't leave the port. At the end of the day, it's workers, not capitalists, who actually make the world go round. There's no reason to let capitalists take that for granted. As I mentioned at the beginning of the video, you can now find Second Thought on Means TV, the home for worker-owned entertainment. I've been working with the team to bring on a bunch more creators, so stay tuned for some exciting new additions to the roster. If you're not already familiar with Means, it's a worker-owned cooperative and explicitly anti-capitalist streaming service. You can find everything from my videos, to original series like Means Morning News, to feature-length documentaries like Abby Martin's Gaza Fights for Freedom, with more amazing content being added every day. As you all know, socialist creators have to walk a fine line here on YouTube. We're always having to contend with age restriction, demonetization, and outright suppression, which for some reason, right-wing outlets never have to deal with. But now with Means TV, we're able to say things the way they are. No pulling punches, no beating around the bush to trick the all-seeing eye of the algorithm. Means TV gives us the freedom to make the content we really want to make and say the things we really want to say. There's even a community forum where creators can engage with each other and their fans right on the platform. And the best part is, Means TV is ideologically dedicated to supporting principled socialist content. As a little thank you for watching my channel, if you sign up with my link, you can get your first month 20% off. Or for an even better deal, you can opt for the annual plan and get 20% off the whole year. A full year of Means TV will run you just $88, which is like the cost of a single DoorDash meal these days. Every person who signs up using my link is directly contributing to the financial stability of my channel and the entire cooperative media project. None of this would be possible without the generosity of viewers like you. Both Second Thought and Means TV are entirely grassroots funded, and they always will be. So if you'd like to help support my work, consider signing up for Means TV using my link. It really does help me and dozens of principled socialist creators all across the platform. If you enjoyed this video, consider dropping a like. If you hated it, a thumbs down. You can check out my other content by following the links on your screen. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you next time.